Well, it is no secret that we are in the midst of a great social, political, and religious transition. The winds of change are blowing hard against Christ's church. For the first time in American history, Christianity is being threatened as opposed to being the status quo. Public sentiment toward Christians is negative, it is suspicious, it is contemptible. Partly because many people are moving away from the truth, as recorded in the Bible, but also partly because many Christians and so-called Christians have lost the ability to defend their beliefs with reason and competence, or have so misrepresented Christianity that they brought reproach upon what they claim to believe. If you haven't noticed, politics are no longer concerned only with law and order and matters of justice, but more and more encroaching upon or redefining morality, ethics, and religious beliefs. This process is called secularization. That's another lesson, but there is a movement there that is going in that direction. American religion itself is going through some major changes. The so-called Christian religions today bear little resemblance to those same religions of 50 years ago. And Christianity used to be the default religion of America. Now it's being overrun with Islam, Eastern mysticism, and even atheism, all which dishonor Christ. There are going to be some who are offended that I even said those things, like we shouldn't give those, you know, religions their due respect. But quite frankly, they have not respected the Son of God, who we claim to honor. And there is the deepest respect, not against us, but against the Son. So what should our response be? Well, we have several options here. First of all, we can pretend nothing's changed. We can take the ostrich approach and dig our heads in the sand and pretend that nothing's really going on. But change is all around us, everywhere we look. And many Americans are no longer sympathetic toward the Christian religion, but rather antagonistic. And persecution, outright persecution, may be next. We're told in Matthew 5:11, "Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me." That's what Jesus said. But that's never going to happen if no one even knows that we belong to Christ. Or we could lay low and wait for this thing to blow over. But there's no indication that it's going to blow over anytime soon, if at all. And if we lay low, how in the world are we going to preach and proclaim the gospel of Christ? Which is exactly what we're told to do, to go and stand, speak the gospel, the message of this life. How are we going to do that? Or we could just run and hide and not let anyone know that we're a Christian for fear of being found out and then targeted, or for fear of offending someone of some godless belief. But we're told that if we don't honor Christ, then he won't honor us. And if we're not going to confess his name, well, then why should he confess our name to the Father when we have our presentation before him? Or we could join forces with other religions and denominations to increase our voice and protect our rights. But how are we supposed to join hands, much less our prayers, with those whose doctrines violate the gospel? We're told that if anyone doesn't hold to sound doctrine, that we're not supposed to endorse them and give party to them. We're supposed to refrain from them and identify those people. Or we could also abandon the faith, which, if you think about it, is pretty much the most useless response of all, the most hopeless one we can think of. Or we could do this one thing that I'm going to talk about for the rest of the lesson. We could actively be doing what we ought to have been doing all along, and that is fixing our eyes on Jesus. That's what we should be doing, especially those of us who have named the name, those of us who call ourselves Christians. We've got to fix our eyes on Christ. In Hebrews chapter 12, if you haven't been there already, in verse 1 through 3, the writer there says, "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart." We're to fix our eyes on Christ because he's the author and perfecter of our faith, but we're also to fix our eyes on him so that we will not grow weary and lose heart. There's a purpose for our fixing our eyes on him then. It's not just because, well, he's a figurehead in our religion. You know, he's a token of our faith and that sort of thing. But it also applies here that if we don't fix our eyes on Christ, then we will get weary, we will lose heart, and we will succumb to all the fears and the pressures and all the conflicts there that are that we're going to face as believers. Of course, fixing our eyes on Jesus doesn't mean merely talking about him and singing songs and thinking about him. It really means putting your earnest effort, your full effort, into following him regardless of the cost. And we've quoted many times Matthew 16, 24. We'll quote it again because Jesus said it and because it's so relevant, that if anyone wishes to come after him, he needs to deny himself and take up his cross and follow him. That's what he needs to do. That's what the Lord said needs to be done. And that's not a one-time thing. That's an ongoing thing. Any of us who become Christians, we need to keep denying ourselves, keep taking up our cross every day, and keep following him. That's what this lesson is all about. Well, we're told in John chapter 14, verse 6, Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." And when we talk about Jesus and the gospel of Christ, we're really not talking about two different subjects. We're talking about one and the same. When we talk about Jesus and truth, we're not talking about Jesus or the truth as if they were two separated things and we need to pick one or the other. We're talking about one and the same. What Jesus commands us is as important as the right and the authority he possesses to command us. He can't be the embodiment of truth if he himself is anything less than truth. So when we're talking about Christ, we're talking about the truth. And that's what I was talking about when we consider any religion, any other gospel, any other belief system that opposes Christ. It is not true because Jesus is the truth. And anything different than that, different than him, anything other than that, other than him, is not the truth. That doesn't mean there's no truth about it at all or that there aren't partial truths throughout it. It means that as a whole, it is not the truth. And in 1 John chapter 4, verse 5 and 6, think about what John says. They are from the world, therefore they speak as from the world, and the world listens to them. We are from God. He who knows God listens to us. He who is not from God does not listen to us. And by this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. You say, well, who are the they? Well, if you read the whole text there, before and after, it is those who deny the divine nature of Christ, the sonship of Christ, him being the Son of God. They do not recognize that, will not recognize that, and they are the they in this passage. But that also applies to anyone who denies the truth of Christ, because if you deny Jesus is true, then you deny that he's the Son of God as well. Or that Christ is the truth, or that his truth is essential. If you deny any of those things, well, then you're denying the Son. Those who are from God are not known because of the pew they sit on, or because of the Bible verses that they know, or because of the songs that they sing, or because of the name that they call themselves, or because of the church that they attend. They are known because of the truth that they listen to and obey. That is the deciding factor. Are we listening to the truth? And the only way you can listen to the truth is to listen to Christ, because Jesus is the truth. Jesus said it himself, "I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me." In John chapter 16, verse 33, Jesus says, "These things I have spoken to you, my disciples, so that in me you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation, but take courage, I have overcome the world." Well, today, as I said, we are facing unprecedented opposition to the gospel truth, that is, to Christ himself in America. And yet it doesn't mean, and I don't want you to think that it means, that Christ is growing weaker or becoming less important or losing control or somehow has been overthrown or is even threatened to be overthrown. Christ died on the cross, but he doesn't remain dead. And I think that we should think about that when we talk about him on the Lord's table. Understand that he died. It was necessary that he die, but don't leave him hanging there on the cross for all eternity, because he's not there. He's at the right hand of God, exactly where he needs to be, exactly where he promised to be, exactly where the Father invited him to be, because he's the only one worthy to sit there. There's not anyone else in the world or all of history who has been invited to sit there. Let the religious implications of that statement fall wherever they may. Christ died on the cross, but he's no longer dead. Those who plotted against him could not contend with his power or his authority, or the power and authority that he possesses. Death itself was no match for the Son of God. And Satan himself is no match for the Son of God. There are some religions, major religions, who think that there is this dualism thing going on where there's a good power and an evil power, and both of them are contending for each other, or contending against each other, rather, for power, and that one's going to win, and we think the good one's going to win, but there, meanwhile, there's a struggle. That is nonsense. There is not a dualistic approach to the world or to religion. There is God, and then there's everything below God. And Satan is striving to be like a god, but in fact, he is not going to ever have that power and authority. Jesus has already defeated him at the cross, and he well knows it. He just doesn't want us to know it. Christ overcame his enemies. He overcame death itself. He overcame the world, and nothing in this life, or the life to come, is going to overcome him. Even his own death was part of the plan. It wasn't a failure. It was part of the plan. I want you to think now about Christians today. Christ is not losing the battle for us. Secularism, humanism, atheism are not threatening his power or reducing his value to humankind. We're told in Hebrews 13, verse 8, that Jesus Christ is the same today, yesterday, and every day, and forever, right? He has not changed. He's not diminished whatsoever. Therefore, take courage. Don't be like Peter, who got out of the boat with all kinds of great hopes and great aspirations and you know, great pride. And yeah, you know, I'm talking about when the storm was on the sea and Jesus is walking on the water, and Peter says, "I want to do that too." And Jesus says, "Come," and Peter says, "Okay," and he steps out in the boat, and all goes well until he starts looking at the storm around him. And that's what we can't be doing right now, is focusing on the storm around us. I'm not saying be oblivious to what's happening. What I'm saying is that can't be the source of our focus. But at the same time, having said all that, don't think either that he's not going to allow you and I to face difficulties and conflicts for what we believe. Quite frankly, our faith doesn't mean anything if it's not tested. And the only way to measure real faith is to have it tested and give people a chance to leave behind that faith or to stay with it. The truth is a safeguard for the soul, to be sure, but it's not necessarily protection from all the worldly harm and intimidation of those who hate us. In this world, you'll have tribulation, Jesus says. Don't forget that. Jesus didn't promise otherwise. And you and I, those of us who have committed to this, don't forget that we signed on for that, with that understanding. So we shouldn't be surprised. Like Peter says, don't be surprised when this fiery ordeal comes upon you as if some strange thing were happening to you. The fact is, you should expect that. And the reason why you should expect that is because Jesus promised you that if the world hates him, then it's going to hate everyone who loves him. And if you're going to separate yourself to the Lord, then you're going to separate yourself from the world. And the world is not going to take lightly to that. They're not going to take kindly to that. And the world is going to hate you, not because of who you are, but because of what you've chosen to believe in. Really, because of who you've chosen to believe in. You should accept that from the beginning, and not wonder, why is this happening? What strange thing is happening here? That doesn't mean you have to like it, but it does mean that you need to understand what's going on. If you were of the world would love you. But you've identified yourself with the source of the world's hatred, and so the world is going to hate you along with that. Don't be surprised. Now, if we claim to love Christ and love the truth, realize that's not an either-or proposition. You can't love Christ or love the truth. If you love Christ, you must love the truth, because Jesus is the truth. Christ is the truth. The gospel of Christ doesn't teach that we choose between love and truth. In order to show love to God and to our fellow man, we have to have a love for the truth that transcends how or whether people listen to that truth. What I'm saying here in plain terms is you have to love the truth and manifest that love for the truth regardless of the consequences to that action, regardless of what people say to you. There's a lot of cowards in our society today. And those people who think that they're being all noble because of base and deviant behaviors that they're bringing forward, and everyone's applauding them and all that, they're the real cowards, because they're not willing to stand up for what is true. They're only willing to stand up for what they want to be true. Those who are willing to stand up for what is actually true, despite themselves, regardless of themselves, those are the ones who are not the cowards, but the ones who are actually exhibiting faith in the Lord. And yet, how many churches are claiming to be preaching love today and yet diluting the truth because they're afraid of offending or losing an audience? You see, what it really comes down to is numbers. We've got to keep the numbers up, because in numbers is not only a guarantee of success for the future, but also a guarantee of income. And if the numbers drop, the income drops. The church fails, and we don't have a church any longer, and our religion fails. But genuine preachers of Christ must uphold God's truth regardless of who it offends and who it turns away. You say, yeah, you're one of those preachers, right? Actually, I was talking about you too, because we're all preachers of the truth, in as much as we have embraced that truth, in as much as we agreed to follow Christ. Our society is invoking love and truth to defend irresponsible actions, unholy behavior, and then expecting Christians to support and not question that behavior and those actions. And we cannot endorse that. In fact, we must challenge those things, not because it offends us personally or on a personal level or our personal beliefs, but because it is offensive to the truth. And we are here to stand up for the truth. It is offensive to God's love and to God's truth. And that truth cannot be defined or changed by human will or human courts or human laws. We cannot offer love at the expense of truth. We cannot offer truth at the expense of love. Our love for the truth must be so strong that it overrides any hesitation to speak it, even in the midst of a hostile audience. And you might look at me right now and say, yeah, real bold of you to get up in front of a bunch of believers or people at least supportive of that belief and say such things. But what about out there? I should be able to say the same thing out there, and so should you. I don't mean out on the street corner on a soapbox, but I do mean when it counts, where it counts, when you have opportunity. Jesus is our model example, and as much as he loved people, he never compromised, he never circumvented God's truth in order to love people. And if you find yourself compromising the truth of God in order to do what you call love, it's not really godly love that you're practicing. Because godly love and godly truth never work at the expense of the other. They always work hand in hand. And you think about Christ, what he did. He lived what he knew to be true, but he also did so with selfless love. God's truth is not something dependent upon man-made institutions to support it. It's not dependent upon popular approval. It's not dependent upon majority rule. It's not dependent upon United States laws that favor it or a U.S. president that favors it. It's not dependent upon whether or not you like it or agree with it or even abide in it, because God's truth is true no matter what. Think about that statement. God's truth is true no matter what. Christ expects us Christians to love the truth regardless of how this affects us or where it takes us or the consequences of our action. We talk sometimes about this moral excellence, 2 Peter 1:5, with all diligence, add to your faith moral excellence. And what that moral excellence means, and especially in the classical Greek sense, the Greek word from which that comes, it actually means virtue. But what it really means in an expanded sense is it means the manly courage to do what is right, the courage to stand up to do what is right, regardless of the cost, simply because it is the right thing to do. That's what that really means in an expanded version there. And so what we're told when we add moral excellence to our faith is to have the courage to do what is right because it is right, not because someone else is doing it, not because the popular tide is approving of it, not because your friends are doing it, not because your parents are pushing you to do it, not because some preacher is talking about it, not because of any other factor. You do what's right because it's the right thing to do, because it is the truth, and the truth is Jesus. You do it because of Christ. And we're told in Romans chapter 1, part of the reading that was read for us there by David, Romans chapter 1, verse 18 through 20, it says there that those who suppress that truth make themselves out to be fools and deviants. Read the passage, all of it, for yourself. From verse 18 down to the end of chapter 1, you'll see what I'm talking about. Because when people leave behind the truth, they always end up practicing some form of idolatry, which leads to some form of immorality, which leads to a form of deviancy, sexual deviancy, by the way. If you read the passage, it tells you that's the route it always takes once we turn away from that which is right. And that's why those people are fools. Not because of what they're doing, per se, but because of why they're doing it. They left behind the very thing that would have saved them in the first place. And then they try to save themselves. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 10. Those who do not have a love for the truth will perish. And that word perish doesn't mean just die mortally, because we're all going to do that. It means to lose your soul. That's the context in which it is meant there. People are going to lose their souls because they don't have a love for the truth, and of course, because they don't have a love for Christ, because Christ is the truth. On the other hand, John chapter 8, verse 31 and 32 there, Jesus says, if you listen to the truth and obey that truth will lead you to the spiritual freedom that you've been looking for. Really what he's saying is, if you listen to me and obey me, abide by my commandments, love me fully and freely. If that's what you're willing to do, then that truth will set you free. Isn't that what you want? It's freedom. Isn't that what everyone's looking for? It's freedom. You think about that. I want to be free, don't you? I'm not going to be free in this life, though. Not in the way that people are looking for freedom. But there is a guarantee that I will be free in the life to come. And not just because I've escaped here, but because of where I'll be there. And so can you, and so can anyone have that opportunity. Think about that. Your love for the truth leads to the salvation of your soul, freedom from the condemnation. Now, you can't water down the gospel then. You can't water down the gospel truth or preach only part of the truth and purposely avoid the uncomfortable and unpopular and offensive parts of the truth. That's not godly love, because that's just a skewed, self-serving, customized version of love and of truth. And there's lots of people who are catering to that, lots of people who are practicing that, sadly, lots of preachers who are preaching that. Someone says, well, I agree. Well, that's good, but here's the thing. You need to make that personal. You can't just accept the terms. You can't just accept it as a concept. Your mind, your heart, your behavior have to be squarely lined up with what you just said, if indeed you agree with that. What we're talking about here is that fixing your eyes on Jesus requires your mind, your heart, and your behavior. Your mind, of course, your mental agreement to what God says. I agree that that is the truth. Your heart, the conviction behind that agreement. Not only do I agree that it's true, but I'm willing to throw everything I have into that truth, so to speak. I'm willing to stand behind it and surrender myself to that truth. And also your behavior has to be a manifestation of that conviction. Not only do I claim to be truthful, not only do I claim to have a conviction for the truth, but as you know, conviction means a belief so strong that it demands action. I have to act out that conviction in my life. And not just once in a while, and not just on Sunday morning, and not just when people are looking, you know, the right kind of people, the important people, the ones who care about those sort of things. I have to act that out all the time. Because God is always looking. The one that you claim to trust and obey is always watching. There has to be a visible proof of our allegiance. And in light of all that, you can't base your love for Christ upon a complete absence of disappointment in other people. And I hear this so often. You know, well, I would be a strong Christian. I would be a faithful member. I would be more faithful in my resolve, but there's someone in my life that disappointed me. I hear this so often. I've heard it for the last 30-something years. Someone is going to disappoint you. Get over it in some way or another. I mean, I don't mean to be rude about it, but the fact is, this world is filled with people, and people disappoint people. And you're one of those disappointments, by the way, to someone else. And someone is going to disappoint you. This is not where we place our trust and our confidence, is in people. If we did, then we would just have a church of the people. We wouldn't have a church of Christ. You have to look beyond the frailties, the inadequacies, the imperfections, and the inconsistencies of people, including those who call themselves Christians, because they are going to let you down. I have joked about it, but only half so, that if I haven't let you down yet, just give me time. I'm working on it, okay? It's going to happen because I'm not a perfect person, and I'm going to disappoint you somehow. But hopefully your faith, your soul's future is not dependent on me being perfect. If it is, then you're mistaken for that. You're mistaken for making that decision. Don't base your so-called commitment to the Lord on everyone saying the right words and treating you the right way and fulfilling your expectations and making you feel special. That is an illegitimate standard for what we call the Christian faith. So don't succumb to that. I'm telling you straight up, don't succumb to that. Because it's so easy to do, especially when we get our feelings hurt and we walk away disappointed and we go home thinking, how come so-and-so didn't talk to me, didn't say this, and didn't do something that I expected them to do? It's not all about that. Don't make it about that. You ought to love Christ and obey His truth because of who He is, because of what He's done for you, because it's the right thing to do, and you have to have the courage to do the right thing because it is the right thing, not because someone patted you on the back for it. And I know I'm speaking boldly here, but the fact is, listen, things are not getting easier for us out there. Things are getting tougher, and we've got to get tougher. Don't practice a religion of convenience. In other words, don't only love the truth when it doesn't force you to change, when it doesn't ask anything of you. Or don't love the Lord when He doesn't impose upon your traditions or your beliefs or your friends or your schedule or your life as you've come to know it. Don't only love God when things seem to work out. Because sometimes things don't seem to work out, and you need to love Him anyway. Fixing your eyes on Jesus doesn't allow for a superficial association with Christ. It demands a full surrender. Everything is expendable in fixing your eyes on Jesus. Everything is expendable. And if you're going to live with one foot in the world and the other foot in Christ, if that's how you see it, you're no different than the world that wants to live in sin and still feel noble and righteous and justified. That's an empty life. It's based on a false premise, and it leads to a hopeless future. I'm not telling you you can't live that way. I'm telling you that you have no right to live that way, and that it leads to your own ruin. Why would you do that? Why would you choose that? Instead, here's what you can do. You can love without measure, and stop keeping score about how that works out. Stop keeping score about how much you get and how much you have to put out. Stop worrying about how much you have to expend and then how much you get in response. Stop loving just to get the reciprocation of that love. You know, like, I loved you, now you need to love me back. Maybe a little bit more. I scratched your back, now you need to scratch mine. I gave you this, now you need to give me that. I was nice to you, now you need to be nice to me. I invited you to my house, now you know you need to invite me to your house. Stop doing that sort of thing. If indeed you are doing it. Because that's not love. Love says, I'm going to do this because it's the right thing to do. Even if you don't do it in return, even if you hate me for what I've done to you, if it's the right thing to do, love does no harm. Love does no wrong. Doesn't the Bible say that somewhere, like in Romans 13, verse 8? Love does no harm, and it will never do any harm to anyone. Obey the truth, no matter what. Not just when it's convenient, not just when it suits your preference, not just on Sunday morning, and not just to when your friends are watching or when your friends are agreeable to that or to make your family happy. You should be obeying the truth because it is the truth. You should be obeying the truth because the truth is Christ, and you need to be obeying Christ. Think about this. Isn't this what we sign on for? Isn't this the best way to live? You say, well, that's pretty tough. I didn't say it was easy. We're talking about quality, not a matter of difficulty. Isn't it the best way to live? To know that you can get through this life safely and that you can know that in the hereafter, in the life to come, God is going to take care of you more than you can even know. All those other people out there that are faking it or that are resisting that do not have that hope. You can have that hope. And so can they if they would just come to their senses. And that's what we plead for. Jesus doesn't need yet another part-time, half-hearted, Sunday morning only church member. He's got tons of those already. What he really needs is those with a moral courage to stand up and be counted. Those who are willing to fix their eyes on him throughout this whole life. Not just this week, not just today, but for the rest of their lives. Fixing our eyes on Jesus doesn't mean merely talking about him in sermons, singing about him in our songs, invoking his name in our prayers. That's not what that means. It means putting our full confidence in his power and his authority and living accordingly, regardless of who else does or does not do so. Christians will not have a positive and godly influence on the world until we refuse to live like the world, regardless of what everyone else is doing. That's not an accusation when I say that. That's just a fact. The world is not just infiltrating our churches. It is indoctrinating our thinking. It is corrupting our behavior. It is destroying our marriages. It is minimizing our parenting and our families. It is destroying our Christ-like love for one another. All because we are fixing our attention on lesser things. Not because the world is becoming stronger and Jesus is becoming weaker, but rather because we are becoming, in some cases, softer and lazier and less disciplined. You say, well, that's pretty bold, preacher. I'm speaking to myself as well. I can't afford to let my guard down. I can't afford to get soft. I can't afford to get comfortable. This is not a time to get comfortable. This is a time, in essence, for battle. When you put on that full armor of God, what do you think? You're putting on a full armor to sit in a church pew? Or are you getting ready to go into battle? Every day is a battle. Every day is a decision. Every day you need to take up that cross and follow Christ. That's a hard thing to do. Those who fix their eyes on Christ look above and beyond the world. They look beyond this world to a life with him. They strive to honor Christ by representing him rightly, by discipling themselves after him, by teaching his truth, certainly by showing his love. As I said, we are living in a world that is increasingly antagonistic toward the truth because it is antagonistic toward Christ. Yet it pretends to preach love and compassion. And we can't stand by and say nothing in response. We can't claim to be fixing our eyes on Jesus if we refuse to defend what he stands for, especially in our own sphere of influence. And we cannot hide in our church buildings until the storm passes over, because it may not be very long before this government allows us to even have church buildings. You say, well, that'll never happen. Really? It's happening elsewhere in the world. Why won't it happen here if we adopt what the rest of the world is thinking and doing? This storm may usher in God's final judgment on the world. I don't know. It's not mine to say. I'm just saying. Things are not getting better. They're getting harder. In any case, no matter what, the truth must be spoken by those who love it. The question is, are you one of those people? Can God count on you? Do you love the truth? Do you love Christ? Those aren't two different questions. They're two ways of asking the same question. Where's your heart? What do you really want out of this life? What do you think you're heading for? Where's your future? God guarantees a future with him if, there's that condition, if you put your full heart into what he says is true. Believe in Christ. Do what he says to do, to become a Christian and to live afterwards. Do that, and you'll do well. That's what Jesus promises. Do this, and you will live. That's our invitation. If you need to respond to it this morning, if you're ready to become a Christian, be baptized into Christ and take on that name and fight for what is right, or if you have taken on that name and you've been letting the world get to you and take you down, well, you can make a new resolve this morning. I would really want you to make that resolve. I would do whatever I could do to help you in that resolve. Let me say it that way, okay? If you need teaching, if you need a sit-down, if you need a discussion, then why don't you ask something? Ask me, ask one of those that are willing to help you. We want you to do well. If there's anyone here that's subject to that call, come forward if you need to, as we stand and sing that song that's been selected.